Ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the Doctors for COVID Ethics Symposium. He joined us for a prior gold standard symposium, but this time in Doctors for COVID Ethics Symposium number 3, we welcome Dr. Mark Skidmore, who has been helping the Doctors for COVID Ethics. He did a remarkable estimate on early intervention, but he's back now with a new survey. It's been in the works for a while. It's now published as a working paper at his site at Lighthouse Economics, and it's a real pleasure to welcome him to the symposium. Dr. Skidmore, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Catherine, and thanks to Doctors for COVID Ethics for all the work they're doing to help people understand the issues and the risk associated with the COVID-19 inoculations. So I'm glad to start off here. I have a PowerPoint presentation that I think is helpful so that people can see what's happening with the survey.
So just let me launch right in.
Okay, so the title of this presentation, as well as the title of the working paper, is "How Many People Died of the COVID-19 Inoculation: An Estimate Based on the Survey of the U.S. Population." And this was really born out of really a few things. One is just discussions with physicians and doctors with COVID ethics and others who are concerned. Just the incredible number of new reported vaccine injuries in the official reporting systems in Europe, in the United States, and elsewhere, and how that changed over time. And then just the tremendous variability in views about what's happening with injuries and fatalities that may be associated with the inoculation. And so it seemed like, given the uncertainty about how many people might be hurt by this, that a survey would be a good way to triangulate and get a handle on what's happening on the ground based on what people believe in their experiences. And so that was the goal of the survey. It was an online survey of the U.S. population. And again, although we'll do several things with this survey, the primary thing was to try to come up with a nationwide estimate of the number of fatalities and injuries associated with the COVID-19 inoculations. As I said, the survey is about 3,000 people. Balanced on age, income, and gender to the extent possible. So these are pretty close to representative of the general population. The survey was administered in December 2021. We're going to report overall findings from the survey on experiences with COVID illness as well as COVID-19 inoculation experiences. And we're going to use this survey to try to get a handle on inoculation-related fatalities as well as severe injuries and less severe injuries. And then finally, we can also use this to the survey to evaluate the likelihoods of the decision to be inoculated or the likelihood of the factors associated with experiencing an injury or knowing someone who experienced an injury. So let's jump into it. We know, and there are others in this symposium who are going to talk about this in much more detail than I can, but we know that there are clear mechanisms of injury from the gene-based COVID-19 inoculations. I want to talk a little, not so much about that, but turn to the data. We're going to be looking at the CDC data on COVID fatalities, the CDC and FDA data on COVID inoculation adverse events through the adverse events reporting system. Then I'll introduce the survey that focuses on the respondent health experiences as well as the health experiences of the people that they know. And this is how we can get a handle on fatalities. Obviously, if somebody was severely hurt or died of inoculations, they wouldn't be available to fill out a survey like this. So while the health experiences of the respondents is helpful and useful, it's incomplete. And we really want to know something about what happened in their social circles. Even in my own social circle, I know at least 3 people who had significant injury from from the vaccine or the inoculations. And I think that a lot of people have, and that the survey bears that out. And then finally, as I mentioned, look at factors associated with the likelihood of being inoculated or experiencing adverse event, or knowing someone experiencing adverse event. And this is important too, because our experiences and what we perceive depends a lot on our cultural background, our experiences, our family, our political background, especially for COVID right now. It's so politicized. So we want to think carefully about, you know, how and why somebody might lean one way or another in terms of how they think about what's happening. All right, so we've already talked about, in the symposium, others will talk about the mechanisms of injury. The main point that I wanna make here in this slide is that it's not just Doctors for COVID Ethics or other scientists and medical researchers have expressed a concern. Even the FDA and CDC authorities acknowledge the potential adverse events. The thing is they assert that's very rare. Even before the vaccines were approved for emergency use, there's a list of potential impacts that match very much what we think are what other scientists and experts are saying about these types of events. The issue is how rare. Is it very rare or is it more common? And so a survey can help us sort through that to some degree and determine the degree to which it's actually happening in the field. All right, so this list comes from a report, a summary that was given to FDA before the inoculations were approved, the Pfizer inoculations were approved. And so the symptoms that are listed here are very consistent with what many of us think might be happening right now. And on the right-hand side of the slide, you can see this is OpenVAERS reporting on the number of events and deaths. And I've highlighted in yellow some of the most common events. And these are the kinds of things that we're seeing in VAERS as well as I'll show you in the survey as well. So again, both the CDC and the FDA acknowledge these types of events occur. We're seeing them reported in OpenVAERS and VAERS. The difference between OpenVAERS and VAERS, the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System, is that OpenVAERS, for some reason over time, the CDC has removed some of the reported events, and we're not, I don't know exactly why, but OpenVAERS regularly downloads it and they notice that there was this difference. I'm going to rely on OpenVAERS as well as VAERS for our comparisons. Again, everyone agrees that injuries can occur. The main question is how often. And in the paper, I've included in the appendix a list of all of the comments describing the adverse events that they believe occurred among people they know. I've also included a list of significant injuries and illnesses from COVID-19, including fatalities and other ongoing respiratory problems that emerged from COVID-19 itself. So Appendix 2 includes that information about COVID-19 illness problems, ongoing problems as well. And then Appendix 3 lists COVID-19 inoculation-related problems. And it's just a list of pages of comments. And I'm gonna show you what that looks like. Here's a word cloud that shows you the most common kinds of descriptors in the survey. And then off to the left of your slide, you can see some, just a sampling of examples of what people said. And I won't read them, but you can see that a lot of them are related to stroke, heart attacks, blood clotting, paralysis, and not, the average age of the people who may have died because of the inoculation is about 48 years old. There were 55 reported fatalities. Of the question in the survey asks, of the people you know who may have been injured, select the person you know best and tell us what happened. And so in that case, there were 55 reported fatalities. This is the description of people who knew somebody who had significant problems from COVID illness. And so you can see a summary here. And here, there are 150 reported fatalities, and the average age of somebody who died in the survey is 57. Okay, so it gives you a flavor of the responses and the feedback. I don't think this is gonna be controversial to most people who see what's happening. What's controversial, potentially, for people who may not see this, is the number of fatalities and severe injuries from the COVID inoculations. Well, here's a summary of CDC data on COVID fatalities over time. And through December 24th, 2021, there were about 840,000 fatalities. It's very important to note that the CDC changed the definition about how a fatality is determined for COVID-19, but not for other causes. And this occurred just as in March 2020, as this was taking off. But for purposes of our survey, this doesn't seem to matter too much because if somebody passes away and the medical authorities are following CDC guidelines, the loved one will be told they died from COVID-19, regardless of whether there are other comorbidities or complications. And of course, there's a whole question about did they receive effective treatments or not. The person in the survey will be told that person died of COVID. And there are indeed a lot of people who were severely injured or had ongoing problems from the COVID illness. Turning to the data on vaccine adverse events, the yellow little lines are the number of reported deaths for all the vaccines except for the COVID-19 vaccine. And then in 2021, you can see the huge change that occurred. And everybody understands that these reports don't necessarily prove that the vaccines caused the event, but just the pure change over time is a huge red flag that we should take a closer look at. Of course, this is, we know also that only a fraction of adverse events get reported for a variety of reasons, if only because physicians and medical authorities are so busy and it takes a long time to input the data into the VAERS system. So we know that not all of the adverse events get reported. But note the change. Now here's the key to backing out the total amount of, potentially a total amount of adverse events and fatalities. It has to do with this ratio of reported inoculation fatalities to reported COVID-19 illness fatalities. In open VAERS, there were about 22,000 reported inoculation-based fatalities, but 840,000 COVID illness fatalities. So that's about, that ratio is about 2.6%. If we go to VAERS, what is actually reported by the CDC right now for the US states and in DC, there are about 8,000 COVID inoculation fatalities in VAERS, but 839,000 COVID illnesses. So that ratio is about 1%. Right now, the CDC acknowledges, about 9 COVID-19 vaccine fatalities. So that ratio would be 9 to 839,000. So in a survey of 3,000 people with these ratios, we should see some COVID illness-related problems and fatalities, but we should see very few, if any, vaccine-related fatalities from COVID-19. It's just with us, a survey of 3,000 offers us a lot of information, but with something that happens very rarely, we would never see something like this popping up. You'd have to expand your survey far beyond 3,000 to capture anything so rare. So that's something to keep in mind. The National Survey of COVID Health Experiences, again, offers 3,000 completed surveys. There are 5 sets of questions, some about the COVID illness experience of the respondent, the COVID inoculation experiences of the respondent socioeconomic information as well. And these are the 2 key things, the health experiences of people in the respondent's social circles regarding both the COVID illness and the COVID inoculation. And that's the information that we want to back out and use primarily. Key summary stats, about 25% of the respondents experienced COVID. Of the, and 48% of the population, of the respondents were inoculated. This is lower than what is reported by official statistics. I think right now we're over 70%, about 75%. So that's notable. 35% of the respondents knew someone who had, at least one person who experienced a significant health issue from COVID-19 illness. About 24% knew someone who experienced a significant health issue from inoculation. Among the COVID ill, about 25% experienced ongoing lingering health problems. The major ones are respiratory, you know, cough and other kinds of things. A number of them just said, I still can't taste or smell. I had COVID as well, and cashews, I love cashews, but for some reason cashews don't taste as good as they used to. So I think I experienced that. Among the COVID-19 inoculated, 17% had COVID before they were inoculated, and about 13% got COVID after they were inoculated. And then the remainder hadn't had COVID yet. 16% experienced significant health issues after inoculation, and of which 15% were severe. And again, these can range from heart-related issues, feeling sick or nauseated, those kinds of things, many of them less severe. But some severe. This is their own experience. One or two people experienced a heart attack that they think may be associated with the inoculation. The primary portion that we're going to rely on here is the summary statistics for this people's within people's social circles. And here we've asked about the experience of the person they knew best who may have been hurt or experiencing problems from COVID, ongoing problems from COVID illness, and same thing with COVID-19 inoculation. About 14% of the sample knew somebody who died, about 150 people. About 55 people knew someone, the person they know best, died from inoculation. So what we want to look at is, you know, in the survey, the people think or believe that those people died from the inoculation or from COVID. But that doesn't mean they necessarily did die from the inoculation. It may just be coincidental that they would have died anyway. You know, people have heart attacks. It's not an uncommon cause of death. So we can subtract estimated fatalities that might have occurred regardless of inoculation. My preliminary estimate is about 7 or 8 people out of the total social group might have died otherwise, whether or not the vaccine is administered. We also know that people's perceptions are shaped and influenced by their culture, by their political affiliation or leanings. So we want to examine that as well. So let's just come to fatalities. recall in the CDC VAERS data, there were about 8,000 reported fatalities. And that ratio of inoculation-related fatalities to COVID illness fatalities is about 1%. If you take all 50 states and the District of Columbia and look at their reports, you can get a distribution around that 1%. And then we can compare that ratio with the survey ratio. And recall, there were 55 inoculation fatalities and 150 COVID illness fatalities. So here we're about 37.37 or 37%, that ratio. And so you can see that the survey is way outside what we'd expect, even if all of the VAERS reporting were true. Okay, so we're rejecting this hypothesis, all right, resoundingly. There's a difference between the survey and what the CDC reports. And of course, if we moved it to 9 fatalities, as you know, that the CDC and the FDA acknowledge from the inoculations, it's even more disparate. Okay, so if we're not sure about what's happening in the population, we can use this survey ratio to get the population ratio. We know that there are about 840,000 COVID illness fatalities as recorded by the CDC. And so we can just solve for the number of COVID inoculation fatalities in the population. So solving for Y in this little equation here yields about 308,000 inoculation-induced fatalities that occurred since the vaccination effort began. The confidence interval around that 308,000 is about between 215 to 391,000 fatalities. So if we just take the survey respondents at their word in that they believe that these fatalities were associated with the inoculation, caused by the inoculation, we're at about 308,000. We can also back out the ratios of severe adverse events like a heart attack, or blood clot, strokes, severe neurological, things that happened, as well as less severe. In the same kind of thing where we're looking at the fatality estimates in the population to fatality estimates in the survey, using that same ratio to back out severe events and less severe events. In here, our calculations are about 1.1 million severe adverse events in the population and less severe events about 2.3 million. So that is the core, but we know that we have our own biases that can be present. We also know that some of these things would happen anyway. The average age of a person who has a heart attack in the United States is 60, for the first heart attack is 65. In our survey, heart attacks, strokes, blood clots are happening on average in the 40s. So we can back out the estimated number of fatalities that we would have had in that social circle population. Roughly about 30,000 people are estimated to be in this population subgroup of people in the survey that they know well enough to know about their health experiences. So we can back that out. If we take 55 fatalities and subtract about 8 fatalities and then recalculate, we get about 260,000 inoculation-related fatalities. That's my first pass estimate on backing out the numbers of people who might have died regardless of inoculation. It was just coincidental that they died shortly after inoculation. Our perceptions may be influenced by a number of factors, and one dimension is our political affiliation or leaning. So I calculated the number of Democrats who reported knowing someone who died. That is 7. The the number of Republicans, there were 29 who reported somebody who died, and independents, 19. So there is a significant difference, particularly between Democrats and Republicans, and how they perceive what it seems, how they are perceiving what's happening. And I don't know exactly what this difference is attributable by chance in a survey of 3,000, maybe. But I don't think so. I think people see things a little differently through the lens that they have. So I just calculate, and I said, let's superimpose the Democratic view of the world on all of the survey respondents, and what do we get? And same thing with Republicans or independents. And so I've recalculated the estimated number of fatalities under each scenario. So if people sort of saw the world as Democrats do, we might have about 119 estimated fatalities in the population. If they saw them as Republicans, it would be 487, independents, 319,000. So that gives you a range, and it illustrates the challenge with asking questions in a survey like this, because our cultural preferences, our values, everything sort of influences how we see what's happening. The other thing that's very important is that these experiences that we have really affect our health decisions. In analysis that we don't have time to present today, I also looked at the determinants or the factors associated with the likelihood of being inoculated. If you knew someone who was injured from COVID-19 inoculation, it reduces the likelihood that you will be inoculated by 33%. If you knew somebody who had real significant problems from the COVID illness, it increases your likelihood of being inoculated by 16%. We also saw that people who were African American, Hispanic, Asian, or Republican, or independent were less likely to be inoculated. If you're Democrat, Caucasian, or highly educated, you're more likely to be inoculated. Those who indicate they receive information about COVID from alternative news sources were significantly less likely to be inoculated, but those who obtained information from mainstream sources as well as official government sources were more likely to be inoculated. I've struggled with talking with people about these challenges, and these summaries help us kind of see, you know, people's perceptions of things. And I think our best tack is at when people see an experience in an injury within their social circles, their likelihood that they'll ask questions and really start to look at what's happening is much greater. And that's our best opportunity for sharing information. At least that's my sense. All right, so a quick conclusion and then we'll be done. From these calculations, there are about 200,000 to 300,000 people that may have died from COVID inoculation, up to over 1 million experiencing severe adverse events, an additional 2.3 million experiencing less severe events. The official position of the US government is that there are 9 fatalities from COVID inoculation. So which is more believable, 9 or to 200,000 to 300,000? We know that surveys have limitations in able to ascertain, which we've talked about, but it can be a very useful tool for triangulation. If the official government data are accurate, then the survey data should reflect what those numbers are. If they don't, then we have to take another look, and we have to have systematic and transparent inquiry. So this is a call for a real transparent examination and doing autopsies and doing all the things that we can to ascertain what's happening to people who are reported as having died from the COVID-19 inoculations. All right, so that's it. Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be able to share this with you, and Here's my contact information if you want to have any questions or inquiries. Thank you.
So Dr. Skidmore, on behalf of the Doctors for COVID Ethics, thank you so much for doing this survey, for the work. And could you also, the working paper will be up at your website, yes?
Yes, it will be up at my website, which is Lighthouse Economics.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, so you first decided to do this survey, I think it was in October?
Yeah, I
think so. You started to work on it.
Started to, you know, because I was looking at the risk-benefit, cost-benefit analysis, and there was so much uncertainty about both the efficacy of the vaccines as well as what's happening with the injuries and the risks associated with the risks associated with the COVID-19, but also the vaccines and the injuries, that I just felt like it's all over the board. And that, you know, and then we kept talking in COVID, Doctors for COVID Ethics, about, well, we know this is happening far more than, you know, what is being acknowledged, but how much? So a survey can at least give us our own data.
I wanted to mention you had done an estimate of what the impact had been in terms of fatalities of withholding hydroxychloroquine from treatment. So you had looked pretty seriously with a colleague at early treatment.
Yeah, I have what is a very solid paper about that using a cross-country analysis. And because there are many countries that have, you know, malaria as an issue, and HCQ is a common medication. It's just over the counter in Africa and other places. And so so it's kind of a nice natural experiment. You have some places that just have HCQ as part of their health regimen. Right. And then you have it being restricted in places like the United States. And so you can kind of do that evaluation and control for other factors that might have led to more or less COVID fatalities, things like health and age and other factors. And malaria is just something that exists in some places and doesn't in others. So you can use that as an identifier or why you have HCQ. So you have a really good matching, and you can estimate the impacts of having HCQ on fatalities. And
so I think from that, you already knew that there was wide dispersion between experience and what the government was saying, what the CDC and FDA were saying.
Right.
So, but when you first you did a test survey, which I'll ask you about later, then you refined your survey. And I should say, in the working paper, do you have a copy of the actual survey?
Yeah, it's
in the appendix. It's in the appendix, so you can look at it. And then you did the survey. But I dare say it was a very significant experience, both for you and for me, for different reasons. But when you first saw the results, including the descriptions of what people were experiencing from the inoculations, both themselves and in their circle, I dare say you were... I think the word you described was shocked.
I was shocked, you know, because you hear these little bits and pieces and stories about people who've been injured, or and those are shocking. Or you start looking at the data of soccer players who are collapsing and dying, and you see the videos of that, and you're like, wow. And but then you look at just the numbers reported in bears, you think, wow, there's something going on. But when you start to see the descriptions that people are writing about what happened, and these are, you know, I don't know, it just shocked me.
So you have in the appendix the descriptions of, you know, people saying, here's the person, and I really think that's very clever, here's the person I know the best who had an adverse event or death, and you just describe in one sentence. And you see page after page, and it's so, I mean, it's very gruesome to read. And you had some examples in the PowerPoint, but.
Yeah, I really think that just that appendix 3 alone, I mean, that to me is, I mean, it's nice to do the evaluation, but that's the story right there. Just look at Appendix 3 and what people are saying about what happened.
Okay, so I'm going to be a tough guy, because when I look at Appendix 3, I see something else. So I don't just see 300,000 people dead and a million plus adverse events. I multiply that 1.4 times three other people in the family who have been adversely impacted financially and emotionally. And so if you just take the financial and multiple and emotional impact of a vaccine injury or death, because a lot of times it's an income provider or it's a child, and one of the income providers has to stay home now and take care of the child.
Yeah.
So you're talking about not just adverse health events, but adverse financial events that just multiply across the family system. So, you know, I look at your numbers and I see, you know, 3, 4, or 5 million families who are dealing with devastating financial and emotional consequences.
Yeah. I mean, I think that was your, I guess, lens that you started to see with the other vaccine injuries, and the families are dealing with children who were hurt, and then the financial implications of that are enormous. And I think you're right. I don't know how many people have been affected by that. You know, you can't right. work if you're injured in that way. And, you know, financially, it's much more devastating to have an injury than to die almost.
Right. 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 Because, and also if you look, a lot of, you know, many working people have life insurance, but they may not have disability insurance, and workman compensation yeah. is generally, from what we can tell, not covering. And so you're right. Financially, the serious disability can be absolutely devastating.
And there are a lot of people who are being, you know, disabled by this, I think. I think yes. the evidence is demonstrating that.
So my reaction, I was not shocked, but I felt an enormous amount of affirmation, because what I read in the test survey and the survey was exactly what I had been hearing from subscribers globally, but I didn't know how representative it was. You know, and so I was confident that we were dealing with these kinds of numbers, but it was anecdotal. It wasn't systematic. And when you did the survey, it was so, it just gave me enormous confidence in what, you know, the information I'd been getting. And it really affirmed that as very useful intelligence that I could count on. So.
Well, it's, you know, I think it's been a journey for all of us to wrap our minds and hearts around what's happening. It's really hard. You know, I talk with people who might see the world in a lens similar to the way we see them, and they look at these numbers and it is affirming. It's like, oh my God, you know, this really reflects my experiences. On the other hand, I've shared this paper with people I know who are smart, and they look at it and say, I just don't believe the numbers. And they're looking for a reason not to believe them. And
well, because if you had a very different point of view looking at these numbers, the implications of these numbers are very significant.
Yeah. I mean, we were talking about this a little bit earlier. You know, we all want to perceive ourselves as, you know, doing the right thing. And I think right now the challenge for people is that, you know, this issue is being, you know, our good nature to want to be good citizens and good family members are, well, you know, you should wear the mask, and well, you should get inoculated to protect grandma, and you should do this, and don't forget to get your booster, and you know, and oh, by the way, you know, since some people aren't really being honest about it, we need to start showing your vaccine card. And but don't worry, it's really for the greater good that we're going to require you to show your papers. And it just, it plays against our natural instinct to want to be a good person and help. And but then when you look at what's happening, it just creates this dissonance. And so you have to either kind of reject this idea that what I've been doing is helpful.
Right.
And that's really hard to do. Or you can just reject the study and say, oh, that's not enough data, or, you know, that kind of thing.
So I'm really lucky because I wouldn't go along with the missing money. And when you wouldn't go along with the missing money, it leads you down sort of an educational path. And that educational path included John Rappaport, who taught me about all the fake epidemics. And it took me years. He started teaching me about fake epidemics in 1999. And it literally took me until 2008. I mean, he was teaching me about it for 9 years. It took me forever, a decade, to wrap my head around it. And then I went through the swine flu and I said, oh, now I understand how it works. But because of my work on the missing money, all my investment advisory clients were clients who'd been harmed by fraud, including vaccine injury. And I spent about 10 years trying to understand what in the world is going on here. I mean, I read many books, watched many documentaries, but between my vaccine-injured clients or families with vaccine-injured kids and John Rappaport's education, by the time COVID-19 came around, you know, I had had 20 years of it took that long to change my worldview and to be prepared to say, oh, yeah, it's an op. You know, of course it's an op. Don't be ridiculous.
I remember when this first happened, you called me and said, this isn't right. You know, I don't know what's going on yet, but this isn't right. And you and I knew that the financial system was starting to blow up in the August, right. September, October, before COVID actually started happening. And so we were watching that. And of course, as COVID happened and the shutdowns happened and everything, that gave cover for the central banks to increase printing by some 65%, you know. For a lot of people, that's coincidental. Well,
it's not coincidental.
It's the pandemic, and they're doing the right thing by helping us get through this crisis. And of course, now we're seeing a lot of that money flow into the regular economy. We have, 7.5%. Inflation rate, and it's like, oh, that's too bad. It's just a consequence of supply chains, this and that, and the other thing. It's like, did we need to do the shutdown? I think we all know the answer to that.
Yeah. So I do want to compliment the Salieri Report Network because you needed a way to polish the to test the test survey.
Yeah.
And we put it out to. We have an update list that's our public list. We put it out. And I was amazed you got a lot within the first 2-3 days. You got 1,700 responses.
Yeah, I think I got a total of like 2,500, as I recall.
Wow.
I think. I don't remember. I'd have to look. But it was like over 2,000, I believe. And that was really helpful. And again, shocking. The Salieri subscribers have a lens. there were far more people observing vaccine injury in the Salieri subscribers than the general population. I think the Democrat, Republican, Independent, comparison reflects that. I think, that helped me understand what was happening with the difference with the Salieri group.
Right. So the Salieri group looked to me. I forget what their inoculation rate was, but it was lower than
very
the
low.
Rent.
Yeah, really low. Not very many.
Right.
A small proportion.
And they recognized a lot more vaccine injury than the other group.
Yes, they did.
Yes. So
they did. They also recognized a lot of significant people who, COVID illness problems.
Right.
As well. But right. The difference, I think, was in the vaccine injury.
Right. Anyway, but I do want to thank them because they're a very, they're people who love to help and they love to contribute. But if you look at the response you got, You know, you could tell they really wanted an honest assessment to happen. They really wanted to communicate their experience.
Yeah, they did.
So,
I really appreciate them stepping up and taking the time to complete the survey.
It was
many thanks.
That's why I have to say again, having seen all those answers come in and read all the sort of death and gruesome disabilities, and you aggregate it and then repolish, redo, and then take it to the survey firm. You know, this was a huge amount of work. You always, when you describe this, you always underestimate, or you always under communicate how much hard work it took. And I think.
Yeah. I have my regular duties at the university, et cetera. I burned the candle at both ends to get this survey. I thought it was so important to share it. And it's going to be controversial, you know.
Here's why I think this survey is so important. And that is, there's so much emotion and politics around this issue. And to me, asking 3,000 people to describe it, or in the test survey, asking, you know, thousands of people to describe it, if you just collect their voices and then show mathematically what their experience was, to me, that screens out a tremendous amount of noise.
It does. And it should, you know, I don't know if it will, but it should motivate the FDA and the CDC. We shouldn't be putting as much pressure on them. It's just, you know, is 9 fatalities, I'm guessing all of them were related to like anaphylactic shock, that kind of thing, that there was an allergic reaction. And probably, I don't know about the specifics of the 9.
So let me make a couple of guesses. I think the pathology reports backing up the early discussions of the clotting and some of the other things going on, but the pathology reports, I think, have sent, you know, have landed like a missile inside the inner circles of the insurance industry.
Yeah.
And
you mean the Doctors for COVID Ethics ones?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. If you look at what Sutrod and Palmer have done with Burkhardt from Germany.
Yeah.
I think potentially, I'm not a forensic attorney, but I think potentially you're talking about stripping away the liability protections, because this, in my opinion, this proves fraud. And that is frightening. We see Moderna stock is now down 60% from the September high, and their chairman and CEO have both sold over $1 billion of their own shares just recently. And Johnson & Johnson last week announced that they're pulling out, they're going to stop manufacturing the COVID-19 injection. And my question is, did their insurance company tell them that they were going to stop manufacturing it?
Yeah, I'm so thankful for the pathology reports from Doctors for COVID Ethics. I'm very privileged to be able to listen in on the meetings, you know. And if we had a functioning system, we would be having those pathology reports happening at the CDC and FDA.
Right.
And they're not. I don't think there's a single one.
If you look at what Sutrat Bhakti said about the clotting and the Doctors for COVID Ethics, Binder, Palmer, what they said about the clotting, the pathology reports then back that up. And then if you look, again, triangulation of the survey, the survey is, to me, these are all points pointing at the same phenomena and giving affirmation to the same.
And I think it's important to note that, you know, this isn't over. Dr. Ryan Cole is reporting significant increases in cancer.
Right.
Because immune systems aren't functioning the way they ought to. And Dr. Bhakti is concerned about other illnesses cropping up simply because the immune system is affected in a negative way. And so we don't, you know, the survey doesn't capture any of that yet.
Right.
I think maybe one said, you know, the person's cancer came back so suddenly. Maybe it was because of the weakened system. You know, it's hard to say.
In our scenario planning for 2022, one of the axes is the rise in all-cause mortality. Will it be high or low? Because if you look at, you know, there are different projections, but if you look at the high ones, it's quite significant. And, you know, there's not enough yet, but we see life insurance coming out and saying death claims have increased significantly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
40% or so. I listened to an interview, one of them, an Indiana-based firm, and he said, you know what, and it's not all COVID, but he couldn't explain what it was. He just said it wasn't COVID. And, you know, so, you know, one candidate is, well, a lot of people delaying normal treatments and upkeep, health issues. So they're all emerging and catching up to us, which I think might capture part of it. Some of it might be because of suicide or drug-related overdoses, et cetera, which is up, but not by a million.
Right.
You know, so
especially
I think we're going to be studying Indiana, that for a while.
The Indiana insurer was a working population, so they were an employer benefit, which was interesting. Okay, well, is it true that you're going to be working on a second paper related to this and what it means?
Yeah, this one is more on the policy side. I mentioned in the presentation that the likelihood of being inoculated is significantly less if you observe somebody in your network that had a significant inoculation adverse event. I mean, if somebody in your family dies, or is paralyzed or has major blood clotting or something, you know, and it's in close proximity to the vaccination, you're going to think twice about taking the thing.
Right.
And so I think every time we do another round of boosters, more and more people are going to have that experience. I think time is running against this inoculation effort. More people are going to say no.
Right. I don't know if you saw the Rancor presentation last week, but, you know, just in his look at the batches, the average time to death in the first two shots was 18 days, but in the booster was 8 days.
Wow.
Which means that a person is much more likely to associate the stroke or heart attack with the injection.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when it comes to policies like vaccine mandates, which are imposed at this in schools and universities, local governments, statewide and healthcare facility, et cetera. It's important to understand who and how and why somebody might be pro or against those vaccine mandates, or
well, this may be
passports, things like that.
This may explain why the pushback is getting much more, I would say, much stronger.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think there is. And I think it's going to, with each round of boosters, I think it's going to get a little bit more, because more people are going to have these experiences and they're going to think twice and say, well, I got, or if you, if you took the inoculation, you got COVID anyway.
Right.
You know. So is it worth it? You know, and right now we're told that if you take the inoculation, the severity is less, but it can't prevent. I had in the survey had several cases where there was somebody who got the inoculation, got COVID, and died. But it's only, you know, just a,
right.
So, you know, it, I think if you get inoculated, then you get COVID, you're going to say, well, should I even do this? You know, or if I know somebody got inoculated and they got injured in some way or died, that's sort of like a big red flag. You're not likely to want to do it again unless you, you know, you're coerced into it.
Right. The famous after two was Jordan Peterson, who shocked me that he got it and was telling everybody else to get the injection and get over it. And then, of course, you know, he had problems from the injection. And then when they came out, the Quebec minister said, you have to get a third, basically, to do all those things that you were promised you could do after two. He would big headline in the Canadian papers, Jordan Peterson calls the Quebec health minister a scum rat.
Yeah, I saw that.
And demands that he retract it. And then the next week he, you know, surprise, surprise, he leaves his job. So anyway, but I thought that was, you know, that was the kind of conversion I'm seeing in a lot of people who, you know, who took the booster or don't want to take the booster, I should say.
I'm kind of, well, Ron Unz and the Sacker have both sort of been hesitant about, you know, the whole vaccine thing. I'm not buying into that there's something really wrong here and that we should just move forward. It's a real, you know, and I keep hoping that they'll both start to shift. I think Ron Unz is starting to shift. So.
Well, I think, you know, I think your survey can help them. And I think one of the reasons it can help them is it's not one person saying something, it's 3,000 people saying something.
Yeah.
I just think a peaceful, calm, data-driven assessment of the experience of 3,000 people, it says a lot. Anyway.
Yeah.
Okay, so we can find the working paper up at Lighthouse Economics. Give us the URL.
Oh, hang on. It's mark-skidmore.com.
Okay, well, I'll have the link up in the commentary.
mark-skidmore.com.
And I strongly recommend anybody listening to this, go look at it. You know, if you don't have time to read the whole thing, for heaven's sakes, go into the appendix and just look at all the comments.
Yeah.
It's so impactful.
Mm-hmm. And appendix 3 are the inoculation-related comments, injury-related comments. But I think it's helpful to look at appendix 2.
Because absolutely.
There's a lot of description of people who really were affected by COVID in some way. And it's hard to say, you know, all the pieces. And it's one of the most frustrating things. You know, if you're doing any kind of, let's say, annual survey,
uh-huh.
And then in 1 year, you decide to make a change to the question, you can't compare the results of the survey in that year with any of the previous years. And that's what we did with COVID-19. We changed the definition of how we count COVID fatalities.
Right. I like the way you handled that in the paper. I mean, you described it very clearly and why it created a challenge.
Yeah. And, you know, so you can speculate why they did that, right? But
right.
It shouldn't have been done in the middle of something.
Right. Well, clearly, you know, whether it was the funny business around the tests, whether it was the withholding of effective treatments, whether it was hospitals requiring dangerous treatments. I mean, there's a combination of things that you could, you know, you could speculate. There's a lot of funny things going on in those numbers.
Yes. So,
anyway, you know, but the truth always shines through, and especially when people like you are around to help it do so. So, Dr. Mark Skidmore, I want to thank you again. You're going to have to be Hero of the Year again.
There's a lot of heroes, and I don't know about that, but thank you.
Okay. You have a wonderful day, and please keep us posted as you publish this paper and also follow up with a second one. We want to stay abreast of the story. Okay.
All right. Thank
okay.
You so
ladies
much,
and Catherine. Gentlemen, have a wonderful evening, and thank you for joining us on the Solera Report.